Okay, hello there. So this is Dr. Abaddon, and we are going to have a lecture today on Introduction to Microbiology. This lecture is just intended to be a review of the subject. It's not something that I'm attempting to provide to hold people responsible for. So what we have here is our handy dandy kitchen sponge, and here's the title of the lecture: Introduction to Microbiology. And here we go. Okay, so the question is, what exactly is microbiology? Well, the obvious answer to that is that it is the study of microorganisms, or specifically the science of the study of microorganisms, which of course leads to the question of what is a microorganism? And the answer is that microorganisms are both easy and difficult to define. The easy answer is that microorganisms are simply organisms that are small. And this is small as adults, or at the reproductive stage of the organism, not small at some point in the lifespan of the organism, because we all start out small. We all start out as single cells, or almost all organisms do. So not all organisms are microorganisms, even if they're small at some point in their life. It's the ones that are small at the point of reproductive maturity that we call microorganisms. So the reason why it is actually more difficult than that than to define a microorganism is because we really always want to be defining categories of organisms in terms of evolutionary relationships. And the trouble with microorganisms is that you can't define microorganisms in terms of evolutionary relationships. This is because microorganisms are either polyphyletic or paraphyletic, depending on how you want to think about things. That is, that there are macroorganisms that are more closely related to microorganisms than a given set of microorganisms may be closely related to another set. So a good example of that are the yeasts. So the yeasts are fungi, and so they're more closely related to all other fungi, even though they're single-celled microorganisms. But that means that they're less closely related to, for example, bacteria or protozoa than they are to fungi. So the consequence of this is that microorganisms are a grab bag of different types of organisms, all of which happen to be small. To a large extent, this smallness can be thought of as the ancestral state, but to a degree, perhaps in the case of yeast, it's instead a derived state. In other words, there's lots of different ways to be small. So, for example, fungi are microorganisms, bacteria are microorganisms, viruses are microorganisms, most protists are microorganisms. These are all organisms that are not very closely related to each other. In other words, bacteria are not closely related to viruses, are not closely related to protists, are not closely related to yeasts. Microbiology also can be thought of as a collection of techniques, and these, probably not surprisingly, are techniques that are applicable to the study of organisms that, in fact, are small. And so these techniques include aseptic technique. So often we grow small things in batch rather than as individuals. And just as we don't want our farm to become contaminated with wild beasts in our pens, we'd also don't want our microbial cultures to become contaminated with types of organisms that we don't want our cultures to be a part of. And so we employ something known as aseptic technique. And what this does is make sure that our cultures, in fact, consist of only the kinds of microorganisms that we want to be present in those cultures. We also employ a related idea called pure culture technique, and the idea here again is to keep our cultures consisting of just those organisms that we want our cultures to consist of. But in this case, this is not just keeping organisms out of those cultures, but also keeping organisms from evolving within cultures. And in addition to that, initially, the way microbiology works is we take a sample of an environment, and we then isolate from that sample individual microorganisms. And getting these organisms into pure culture, this is the first step of pure culture technique. And aseptic technique is one way of keeping new organisms from finding their way into that culture. And we also have methods that we employ to make sure that the cultures do not evolve to any great extent while we're propagating them. Obviously, microscopes play an important role in microbiology. How else do you, of course, see a very tiny thing as an individual, except through some kind of magnification method? So what is a microbiologist? How does microbiology work? Well, actually, microbiology tends to work in a way where you have a certain organism that is being studied, and that organism simply is in the lab you're working in. But how does it get into that lab? Well, the answer is that all these microorganisms that people work with in labs first have to be isolated. Now, they can be isolated in medical laboratories, they can be isolated from the environment, but the first step in microbiology typically, although this might be multiple generations of researchers back, typically is the isolation of a specific microorganism into pure culture from an otherwise heterogeneous culture. So, what kinds of microorganisms exist? So there are a number of different types of microorganisms out there, as we've already discussed. So perhaps the most obvious of microorganisms are the bacteria. These bacteria can be described as eubacteria or true bacteria, or in fact domain bacteria. These are the prokaryotic organisms that, when you're taught about prokaryotic organisms, these are the type of organisms that you are most likely to have been taught about. So these lack a nucleus, but they're not the only types of organisms that lack a nucleus that are cellular. And the other type are these so-called archaea bacteria, or domain archaea. These also are prokaryotic organisms. It turns out, though, that genetically they're no more closely related to bacteria than they are to the eukaryotes, which are the organisms that have true nuclei. So the eukaryotes, they're members of domain eukarya, and there are a number of types of microorganisms that are members of domain eukarya. There are the protozoa, there are the microscopic algae, and there are the microscopic fungi. Now, what these organisms have in common is that they are not plants, they are not animals, and they also are not macroscopic fungi, so not mushrooms. Or puffballs or what have you. So this is a grab bag of different types of organisms that are similar to one another in terms of their size, but are not necessarily as closely related to each other as they are to other organisms that, in fact, are larger in size. Also included among the microorganisms, or at least microbiology texts, are the parasitic worms or helminths. And these include such things as pinworms and tapeworms and types of worms called flukes. Above are all the cellular types of microorganisms, but there are other types of things that are studied by microbiologists, and these include the viruses. So the viruses are acellular. At a minimum, they supposedly consist of nucleic acid and protein, although there seem to be virus-like things out there that in fact don't consist of protein. They might just be lipids. Among the viruses, are different types. We'll be talking about bacteriophages quite a bit in this course, which are just simply the viruses that infect members of domain bacteria. So the other infectious agents that I was attempting to allude to a moment ago include the prions. Prions are lacking in nucleic acid. They're infectious proteins, and the viroids lack protein, and they are in fact infectious RNAs. These are the viroids are parasites of plants. And there are also ectoparasites. I mean, there's a lot of different parasites out there. The ectoparasites are parasitic. To a degree, that's important to what we're going to be talking about in this course, but they're not small. They're not considered to be microorganisms. By and large, animals are not considered to be microorganisms, even if they're tiny. So this is another way of looking at the types of microorganisms in this world. So we can differentiate the microorganisms into the cellular types versus the acellular types, or living and versus non-living infectious agents, as this figure presents them. And you can see up here under cellular types, we've got the bacteria, we've got the archaea, we've got the eukarya. So the bacteria and the archaea, these are the prokaryotes. And eukarya, of course, are the eukaryotes. Eukaryotes, a number of different types out there. We've got the unicellular algae as well as multicellular algae. These are eukaryotic organisms. They're also algae-type things that are found among the bacteria, the cyanobacteria, but those are not included among in this list right here. We have the protozoa, which by and large are non-photosynthetic organisms. They're heterotrophic. They eat the products of other organisms. We've got the fungi, which are also heterotrophic as opposed to the autotrophic algae. Fungi you're probably very familiar with. They're important for the decomposition, particularly of plant material, but not just plant material. And among microorganisms, the molds and the yeasts are considered are members of the fungi. And then the helminths, which are in fact animals, they're multicellular. Once you get to multicellular, it starts becoming ambiguous whether or not an organism in fact is a microorganism. And just as a matter of course, we're not going to assume that animals and plants are microorganisms. The former kingdom Protista, or the protists, this includes both the protozoa and the algae. It includes as well multicellular algae, including very big multicellular algae, such as the kelps. The protists, in fact, are clearly not all the members are microorganisms. So again, microorganisms can be defined in terms of their size. And the small things are microorganisms, the big things are not. The thing is that cells themselves can gather together into multicellular organisms to make something other than a microorganism. So what we have here is basically the size of bacteria. You really can't see them with the naked eye except as a group of organisms. The very biggest of cells you in fact can see with the naked eye. And then we have multicellular things up here which are really big. Viruses down here are so small you can't usually see them even looking through a light microscope. Here's another representation of scale. So we have a eukaryotic cell up here. We have a nucleus right here. We have a something that's the size of a prokaryotic cell, a bacterium or an archaea. For example, the mitochondria that are found inside of a cell, or for that matter, the chloroplasts are things that are approximately the size of a bacterium. They're usually, but not always, smaller than eukaryotic cells. And then the viruses usually are smaller than prokaryotic cells, although there's some really big viruses and some really small prokaryotic cells. There are also some really small eukaryotic cells, and there are also some really, really big prokaryotic cells. So as with anything in biology, there's always exceptions, but by and large, eukaryotic cells are bigger than prokaryotic cells are bigger than viruses. So if we can talk about the different types of microorganisms one by one, so this is just the different categories. So if we start out with the prokaryotes, so I've put prokaryotes over here in quotes because prokaryotes is a term that some people don't like to use. They don't like to use it because prokaryotes, just like microorganisms, is not a monophyletic taxon. In other words, there are prokaryotic organisms that are less closely related to each other than either may be related to a eukaryotic organism. Particularly the archaea seem to be more closely related to the eukaryotes than they are to the bacteria. So it's not a good phylogenetic category, and people want to get rid of the idea of prokaryotes as a consequence of that. The flip side, however, is that the use of the term prokaryotes is very useful. It's very convenient because it allows us to contrast it with eukaryotes. So when we're describing the bacteria or the archaea, we can describe them as just prokaryotes, and it's my preference to do that. Now, when we're distinguishing among prokaryotes, we can distinguish them in terms of gram staining. There's the gram negatives, there's the gram positives. We also have things like the mycobacteria, which are acid fast stains. Another type of prokaryote are the cyanobacteria, but really cyanobacteria are just really cool gram negative bacteria. Prokaryotes tend to be absorbers. They tend to prefer to live in wet conditions when they're metabolizing. Among the animal decomposers, a good chunk of them are prokaryotes. Prokaryotes tend to have cell walls, but that's not always the case. In the case of the bacteria, those cell walls consist of peptidoglycan. And prokaryotes typically live as unicellular organisms, although they can live as arrangements and they can exist as clonal microcolonies making up biofilms. So although we typically think of them as unicellular, that's not really the whole story. Nutrient types. So prokaryotes can be chemoheterotrophs, they can be photoautotrophs. The chemoheterotrophs are consumers of chemicals, both for energy and for the sake of gathering organic carbon. Typically, they gather these chemicals via absorption across their cell envelope. The photoautotrophs, they get their carbon from CO2, and they get their energy from light. So these are the typical photosynthesizers. The cyanobacteria are included here, and the green plants, not a microorganism, are included there as well. There are also these weird categories, photoheterotrophs and chemoautotrophs. The photoheterotrophs are able to gather energy from light, but they get their carbon from organic molecules, not from CO2, unlike the photoautotrophs. And the chemoautotrophs, these are in some ways even stranger. They get their energy from typically inorganic reduced compounds, minerals basically, energy-rich minerals, and they get their carbon from carbon dioxide, just like cyanobacteria or plants do. Durable state. So an important example of a durable state among microorganisms are the endospores. These are seen predominantly with the gram-positive bacteria. These are the bane of sterility because they're very difficult to kill. The last things that die when you're sterilizing a culture typically will be the endospores. And then diseases, there's lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of different diseases that are caused by bacteria. Whether archaea cause disease is a completely open question. Certainly there seems to be an underrepresentation, if in fact any archaea that cause disease. And we also have to keep in mind that although lots of diseases are associated with bacteria, the vast majority of bacteria in this world do not cause diseases, nor do they serve as commensal organisms necessarily. So these are just some pretty shapes of bacteria. We have a rod shape with lots of flagella. We have, again, rod shape, shorter rods. Another rod shape, again with flagella. Again a rod shape, more rods and more rods. And then bacteria also can be found which are spherical. The diplococcus are two spherical cells that are hooked together in an arrangement. Streptococci are chains of spherical cells. Staphylococci are these grape-like groups of spherical cells. And here's some images of these spherical cells. Now, if you get a cell that is a rod, if it's short enough, you won't be able to tell a difference between it and a coccus, in which case we call it a coccobacillus. And this is because the rod-shaped bacteria we call bacilli. This is an example of a gram-stained, probably Staph aureus. It's a Staphylococcus, but Staphylococcus aureus is a specific species, and this is Streptococcus here. There are spiral-shaped bacteria. There are spiral-shaped bacteria, a special kind called spirochetes, Borrelia burgdorferi, which causes Lyme disease, is a spiral-shaped bacterium. We can consider microorganisms, the bacteria particularly, in terms of their oxygen requirements. And so we have bacteria that use oxygen, and we have bacteria that don't use oxygen. We actually have also some that are somewhere sort of in between. We also have the way in which energy, ATP, is generated. There are bacteria with electron transport chains, and then there are bacteria that can generate energy in the absence of electron transport chains. So most familiar would be the bacteria that use O2 and also use electron transport chains. These are most familiar because these are the metabolic processes that basically we go through. So we have the aerobic respirers. These again are organisms that use oxygen. Aerobic and respiration, in fact, refers to utilization of an electron transport chain. And among these are the obligate aerobes, which have to have O2 in order to metabolize. This is actually somewhat of a lie, however, because there are obligate electron transport users that can use O2, but nonetheless can use certain inorganic molecules as their final electron acceptor instead, such as nitrate. We have facultative anaerobes. Facultative anaerobes, in fact, can go either way. Under conditions where there's oxygen, they use their electron transport chain, but under conditions where the oxygen is lacking, they instead can ferment. The problem with fermentation is that the amount of ATP that's produced per unit of energy-rich molecule is relatively low. On the other hand, the fermentation pathways are much easier and cheaper to set up and much more rapid to set up. So there are trade-offs between these. If you've got oxygen around, if you can utilize an electron transport chain, you've already set it up, it's good to use that oxygen. Alternatively, fermentation can be a good choice, particularly under conditions when there isn't any oxygen around. Among those organisms that can metabolize using an electron transport chain are those that can do so even when oxygen is not around. And we just alluded to that. These are the organisms that can go through respiration, but they use something other than oxygen as their final electron acceptor. And mostly these are chemolithotrophs, but Pseudomonas is able to, in fact, utilize their electron transport chain under certain conditions, under anaerobic conditions. And then there are the fermenters. So the fermenters don't have an electron transport chain or don't use the electron transport chain, particularly under oxygen-lacking conditions. The strict anaerobes are stuck with just using fermentation and, in fact, can't even survive in the presence of oxygen. The facultative anaerobes, in fact, go back and forth. When there's no oxygen, they ferment. And when there is oxygen, they use an electron transport chain. And the aerotolerant anaerobes instead are organisms that are unable to use an electron transport chain. They lack one, so they get all their ATP from fermentation, but they have no problem with being in oxygen-containing environment. So this is uses oxygen versus does not use. It doesn't say this is an oxygen-containing environment versus one that is not. So the cyanobacteria, in fact, are a kind of bacteria, as kind of makes sense given that bacteria is in their name. They used to be called blue-green algae, and it was not always appreciated that they essentially were bacteria rather than eukaryotic organisms. The cyanobacteria, in fact, are an important producer found in aquatic ecosystems along with the eukaryotic algae, hence the confusion. So the cyanobacteria, because they're bacteria, they're a kind of prokaryote, they're a kind of eubacteria, they're not archaea, they in fact are bacteria. And they also are gram-negative bacteria. Their characteristics, they are photosynthetic. They are mostly aquatic, but not entirely. There are some that don't quite live in the water. We are familiar with them as the components or key components of green lake scum. Chloroplasts are also a kind of cyanobacteria. They're descendants of free-living cyanobacteria. These are organisms that, in fact, serve as endosymbiotic bacteria living inside of plants as well as eukaryotic algae. In terms of nutrient types, the cyanobacteria are photoautotrophs, which means that they get their energy from light and they get their carbon from CO2. In terms of diseases, there are toxins that are associated with certain kinds of cyanobacteria, and also they can smell bad. And then here are some pretty pictures of cyanobacteria. They're green. They're plant. They're green like plants, and they're green like green algae. And there's not a huge lack of coincidence there. There's a reason why all three of them are approximately the same color. So moving on to eukaryotic algae. So eukaryotic algae are not plants, although plants are descended from types of eukaryotic algae, specifically certain types of green algae, of multicellular green algae. So like the cyanobacteria, the eukaryotic algae, in fact, like all algae and plants, they're photosynthetic. The eukaryotic algae, by and large, are aquatic, and they're all eukaryotes, hence, of course, the name eukaryotic algae. They come in a variety of types, such as brown algae, red algae, green algae, diatoms, also golden algae, dinoflagellates. Eugalanoids also can have chloroplasts, and therefore, as eukaryotic organisms, can be viewed as eukaryotic algae. They tend to have cell walls. There are both unicellular and multicellular types. Eukaryotic algae can grow quite large. Kelps are rather huge organisms. The unicellular types are not necessarily the biggest things around, and they, in fact, are microorganisms. In terms of nutrients, they, again, like the cyanobacteria, get their energy from the sun, from light, and they get their carbon, their organic carbon from CO2. They're carbon fixers, they're producers. These are the organisms that, in most environments, provide the chemical energy that serves as the base of the ecosystem. In terms of durable states, there are cysts associated with eukaryotic algae. Again, like the cyanobacteria, these are organisms that need to be able to survive, in many cases, from time to time, as a consequence of their environments drying up. So think of a pond that isn't always filled with water, yet the algae somehow survive. How do they survive? They have durable states that allows them to survive the desiccation that occurs when the pond dries up. There are, in fact, a number of diseases that are associated with eukaryotic algae. As you'll see, a lot of these are shellfish poisonings, and the reason for that is that the shellfish that are associated with these diseases are filter feeders, and part of what they filter out of the water are, in fact, eukaryotic algae, and these eukaryotic algae have toxins associated with them that can affect us when we ingest the shellfish, and therefore the eukaryotic algae or the remains and the toxins. This is just pictures of eukaryotic algae. That's a dinoflagellate up in the corner there. So then there are fungi. So fungi include yeasts and molds, but also macrofungi. The yeast and molds are considered to be microorganisms, whereas the macrofungi, of course, are big things by and large. The yeasts are unicellular fungi. The molds, by contrast, are filamentous fungi. So you can think of these things mostly as sort of single cell thick organisms that happen to be consist of multiple nuclei that are quite long, whereas the yeasts are relatively short and consists of fewer or only a single nucleus. They're eukaryotes, just like the eukaryotic algae and the protist. They are nutrient absorbers, which means that they tend to live with inside the substrates that they are consuming, and they tend to digest those substrates using exoenzymes and then bring the products of the digestion back into their cells. They have cell walls. In fact, they're chitinaceous cell walls. They prefer drier conditions typically than do bacteria. It doesn't mean, in terms of where they metabolize, it doesn't mean that they prefer to have bone dry conditions, but the level of moisture tends to be not as, the levels of moisture don't have to be as high for many fungi as they do for many bacteria. And the fungi serve as key plant decomposers. In fact, they're very much associated with plants. They serve as symbionts of plants, and they serve as pathogens of plants. important pathogens of plants and important symbionts, the mycorrhizal fungi, for example, which contribute to the uptake of minerals and for the plant roots. And they also serve as decomposers of plant material. Unlike the algae, the fungi are chemoheterotrophs. This is just like us. They get their energy and they get their organic carbon by eating other organisms. They don't ingest those other organisms. Instead, they live inside those other organisms or their remains, and they break down the tissues of those organisms and then take those tissues up, take the breakdown products up into their cells. They are very good and very important decomposers. The fungi, in fact, disseminate using spores. These are not the same thing as endospores. They're fairly durable. They have to fly through the air. They're desiccation resistant. And fungal diseases are known as mycoses, and examples of such diseases are candida, ringworm, athlete's foot, jock itch. These are all fungal diseases. This image here is of ringworm. So ringworm is not caused by a worm. It's caused by, in fact, a fungus. And there are about 100 human fungal pathogens, which, you know, is a relatively large amount. And there are lots and lots and lots of fungal pathogens of plants. So protozoa or protist. So protozoa, the word protozoa and the word protist are not identical. Protozoa can be thought of as a subset of the protists. The protists are basically eukaryotic organisms that are not plants, animals, or fungi. And the protozoa, by and large, are single cellular eukaryotic organisms that are not algae. So they're not photosynthetic. But there's a little bit of wiggle room there. There are, in fact, things that are sort of protozoa-like that also have chloroplasts, and the euglenoids are an example of that. The protozoa particularly are unicellular. They come in the form of flagellates, ciliates, amoebas, etc. They are cellular, but can exist in some species instead as multinucleated organisms rather than multicellular. And we have basically things like the plasmodial slime molds as that form. The cellular slime molds, typified by Dictyostelium, is also a quasi-multicellular organism that nevertheless is found under the heading of protist because it's not an animal, plant, or fungus. So these are eukaryotes. Many of them are parasites, but most of them are not parasites. They tend not to have cell walls, contrasting the eukaryotic algae. They tend to be engulfers, so that's phagocytosis, and or absorbers, and they tend to prefer to live in wet conditions. They're chemoheterotrophs, like the fungi are, like we are. They get their energy from chemicals, and their organic carbon also from chemicals. And depending on how you classify protozoa, you may or may not include the photoautotrophs as well. And certainly the protists include the photoautotrophs, the eukaryotic algae. Some form cysts as a durable state. Again, if you're living in an environment that can dry out, you need to be able to survive until it becomes wet again. There are a number of different diseases that are associated with protozoa, such as malaria and giardiasis and amoebic dysentery, etc. And there are a total of about 30 human pathogens. And here are some pretty pictures. That's an amoeba. That is a ciliate. That is a ciliate, and that's a euglenoid. So contrasting what we have talked about so far in terms of what are microorganisms, we talked about things that consist of cells. For the most part, they're unicellular, but there are also microorganisms that are colonial, and colonies take on various types. What they are not, typically, are multicellular organisms. So microorganisms and multicellular organisms don't, by and large, go hand in hand. Now we'll talk about something completely different, I mean reasonably familiar for those of you who are studying biology, are the viruses. Now the viruses do not consist of cells, instead they're acellular. So viruses are not cells, they're acellular. And what they consist of is a capsid and other proteins that is associated with the nucleic acid. The nucleic acid is the genome of the virus, and the protein or capsid protects the genome and also helps the virus obtain cells. Some viruses have lipids in addition to their protein capsids. And these lipids also serve a role on the outside of the virion particle. That is, they're external to the nucleic acid, and they play roles in both protection of the nucleic acid and obtaining new cells, as well as does the protein. So they're acellular. We call the state that the viruses are in when they're outside of the cells as virions or virion particles or free viruses. If they're bacteriophages, they could be called free phages. All viruses are obligate intracellular parasites. That means that they need to be inside of a host cell in order to replicate. There are obligate intracellular parasites other than viruses. So there are certain bacteria, for example, that serve as obligate intracellular parasites. So not all obligate intracellular parasites are viruses, but all viruses are obligate intracellular parasites. Virus genomes vary substantially, more so than really anything else out there, but that's simply because we call a lot of different things viruses. So they are DNA or RNA, they're double-stranded or single-stranded. Some of them, viruses, many of viruses, in fact, have genomes that are one piece, monopartite, and there are other kinds of viruses that genomes are broken up into segments or bipartite, for example, or tripartite. Or more. The virus nutrient type really isn't applicable to viruses. They do consume of sorts host cells, but even that they really aren't doing. What they do is serve as molecular parasites. That what they steal in terms of quote-unquote nutrients are basically molecules that are found inside of the cells that they're infecting. The durable state typically is the virion particle, although viruses can find themselves inside of durable states of other organisms, such as endospores, and therefore are able to survive in the environment for long periods until conditions are such that growth is possible again. So many are more durable infecting rather than free. You think of something like HIV, which isn't very a human immunodeficiency virus, which causes AIDS. It's a very wimpy virus outside of the body. It falls apart very readily. And then as noted, some can encase in a durable state of the host, such as an endospore. So viruses have a number of different ways of enduring environmental stressors. Diseases caused by viruses, like bacteria, there's a lot of diseases caused by viruses, the common cold, influenza, HIV, AIDS, herpes, various kinds of herpes, chickenpox, which is actually a kind of herpes, lots of different kinds of diseases caused by viruses. Importantly, though, viral-caused diseases do not respond to antibiotics. Antibiotics, essentially by definition, are antibacterial drugs. So these are examples of virion particles associated with different types of viruses. We have viruses that have a helical capsid. We have viruses that have a geometric icosahedral capsid. We have viruses that have envelopes. You can see that there is a helical capsid inside of the lipid envelope, and on the outside of the lipid envelope are these proteins that are used for the virus to attach to cells. There are also viruses with more complex morphologies. This is an example of a bacteriophage. So you can also see differences. This is an RNA virus, that's a DNA virus, that's an RNA virus with multiple segments, and this is a DNA virus. And then here are electron micrographs of these various things. So viruses differ in a number of different ways. They differ in what their genomes look like. They differ in what their are like, rather. They differ in what their their capsids look like, their virions look like, which is more or less saying the same thing. And they also differ in terms of how they infect cells. By and large, those viruses that have lots of genes tend to be less reliant on the host enzymes, and those viruses with fewer genes tend to be more reliant on host enzymes. So here we've got increasing size of the virus. This is basically in terms of genome size and dependence on host cell DNA synthetic enzymes. And it ranges from totally dependent to largely independent of host enzymes. Just different strategies that different viruses have for surviving and replicating. And then let's also not forget that there are plasmids and transposons, and there are differences between different viruses, such as phage-lytic chronic and lysogenic infections, and the equivalent that one sees with the viruses. You also have bacteria binary fission as another example of replication that we haven't talked about yet. Just lots and lots and lots and lots of different details that are associated with microbes. And here's an example of a viral lytic pathway. So we have the virus here, we have the cell it's infecting. In this case, it's a bacterium, it's presumably E. coli. The virus attaches to the surface of the bacterium. It ejects its DNA into the cytoplasm, in this case it's the DNA virus, into the cytoplasm of the cell it's infecting. In the case of this virus, the host genome chromosome is broken down. This adsorption and uptake phase is followed by a synthesis phase where you have synthesis of the proteins and the nucleic acids, particularly the chromosome of the virus taking place. Here we have assembly where these components that have been synthesized get together, and then you have a release step, and with the lytic virus this release step occurs via lysis, which is essentially a destruction of the cell envelope. Here we see details of the assembly phase. It's showing that the head of the virus, the capsid where the DNA resides, and the tail of the virus and the so-called tail fibers all assemble separately and then get together as one unit. Also with bacteriophages, and contrasting the lytic cycle, is what's known as a lysogenic cycle. So a lysogenic cycle is associated with phages that are known as temperate phages. They're called temperate because they, in fact, don't have a high amount of virulence against the host that they infect, at least not in the same way that lytic phages do. However, that's actually a misnomer. The temperate phages, by and large, are also lytic phages, as we saw back here, lysing the host cell. Here we have a lytic cycle, so adsorption, uptake, synthesis, biosynthesis, assembly, and then release via lysis, adsorption, and so on and so forth. And here we have instead a lysogenic cycle. In a lysogenic cycle, rather than initiating the lytic cycle, you instead have the viral genome integrating into the host in some manner, typically into the chromosome of the host itself, and thereby serving as what's known as a prophage. And as a prophage, they can replicate along with the host cell, but they don't make virion particles. So here we have the host cell going through binary fission, as we just mentioned, and we have replication of the chromosome of the bacterium. And in the course of this replication of the chromosome, you also have replication of the phage genome that's found integrated into that chromosome. And so here we have a single daughter cell, and it's essentially a duplicate of the parent cell, and there'll be another daughter cell. Now you can also have what's known as induction. And in induction, what you have is literally the induction of the lytic cycle, or at least the productive cycle, to be more general. Here you have the chromosome, the prophage, popping out of the chromosome of the host cell, and then genes are expressed that lead to the production of virion particles, which are then released from the cell via lysis. So again, temperate phages are lytic phages. They're not the dichotomy isn't between lytic phages and temperate phages. You can use the word virulent phage versus temperate phage if you like instead, or obliquely lytic is what I prefer for the non-temperate phages. And again, the temperate phages are the ones that display lysogeny, and they're not called lysogenic phages, even though a lot of people like to use that phrase. So next on the list is something that, arguably isn't a microorganism at all. These are the helminths. And the helminths include, well, these are parasitic worms. These include flatworms, or members of phylum Platyhelminthes, or roundworms, which are members of phylum Nematoda. These are known as metazoans. Basically, a metazoan is an animal. So they're multicellular animals, and they're parasitic. Some are engulfers, some are absorbers. The way they get their nutrients, they're all chemoheterotrophs, as basically animals are. They have durable states, eggs and cysts. I don't know too much about helminths, but I'm making a little assumption here, hence the question marks. So the diseases associated with helminths include trichinosis, hookworm, tapeworm. Here we have the scolex of the tapeworm, or it's basically its head where it attaches to the intestinal wall, and that's a flatworm flying across down there. So microbes and ecology. So it turns out, probably not surprisingly, that microbes are incredibly important to ecology. I guess it is surprising if you're used to just thinking about big things in ecological context, but really a lot of the underlying ecosystem ecology, as well as community ecology, is going on. That is, interspecific interactions is going on in terms of what the microbes are all about. So microbes are producers. So the plants are producers. They produce the chemical energy that powers ecosystems. When there's no light around, it's really the microbes that are the producers. They're taking chemical energy and converting it into basically organic molecules. So they provide energy to ecosystems, and this is particularly so in aquatic ecosystems. In terrestrial ecosystems, it's the plants that dominate. Microbes are fixers. So fixers basically are organisms that take relatively unavailable forms of chemicals and convert them into more available forms of chemicals. And especially things like nitrogen, the microorganisms are responsible for converting into a form that's readily available to other types of organisms. So-called nitrogen fixing. Microbes are key decomposers. That probably doesn't come as any surprise at all. That's important in terms of the ecosystems and ecosystem ecology, because what they're doing is they're freeing up nutrients that are trapped inside no longer living organisms. And these could be, for example, well, especially inorganic elements, nutrients, basically minerals that therefore find their way back into, for example, the soil. Microbes form symbioses. We'll be having a whole chapter on symbioses that involve microorganisms. The mycorrhizal fungi, they're associated with plant roots. Bacteria are found in legume root nodules. These are the nitrogen fixers that are associated with these types of plants. The mycorrhizal fungi essentially serve as the equivalent of root hairs for plants. Microbes also serve as endosymbionts, which you've mentioned already, which are the things like chloroplasts and mitochondria, but there's actually a larger variety of endosymbionts than that. These basically are bacteria, usually it's bacteria living inside of the cells of other organisms. Microbes are important in disease, so that microbes can cause disease, not surprising, but microbes can also prevent diseases. The pathogens are basically microbes, although there are parasites that are not microbes. There are good microbes that can be associated with, for example, your body, that can be antagonists to bad microbes. One of the things that goes wrong during antibiotic treatments is that you can wipe out the microbes that are responsible for preventing the pathogens from growing, such as Clostridium difficile. Microbes also produce antibiotics. That's where our antibiotics originally came from. And of course, those can be used to treat diseases, but they also can fight competitors, for example, in soils. These are other organisms that can take up space or utilize nutrients that, if you can eliminate them, that's good for you. You meaning a microorganism. The single most important achievement of modern medicine is the ability to treat or prevent microbial diseases. And the germ theory of disease is the idea that microbes, in fact, cause diseases. We didn't always know that. In fact, it was only a little over 100 years ago that people really started, 150 years ago, let's say, really started to get a handle on this idea That there are germs out there, and germs can cause disease. And if we can prevent the germs from contaminating us, we can prevent disease. Of course, people these days have taken that idea perhaps a bit too far. Most microorganisms, nevertheless, regardless that there are microorganisms that cause disease, most microorganisms don't cause disease in any organism, including ourselves. There are microorganisms that are found in association with our bodies. These are called normal flora, either microbiota or microflora. Normal microbiota, normal microflora. These are by and large harmless, but not always harmless microorganisms. They are associated with every part of your body that comes in contact with the outside world, with just a few exceptions. And this figure I've been using for really almost 2 decades, ever since we had Google searches, basically. I was just looking at body, and what I found is this, and I just love it. So this is an image indicating that, in fact, we have associated with us microorganisms in all sorts of locations in our body, except parts of the lungs and to some degree the stomach. This is a representation of how we classify organisms generally. This is the three-domain system: domain bacteria, domain archaea, domain eukarya. Note that archaea and eukarya are shown as being more closely related than the eukaryotes are to the bacteria. Each of these lines here basically represents a kingdom level of genetic diversity. You can see up here, here's the animals, here's the fungi, here's the plants. These are individual kingdoms. Of course, in the five kingdom classification, which is what we learned when I was going to school, there's the animals, there's the fungi, there's the plants, there's the protists. So those are our protists right there. Everything but the animals, the fungi, and the plants. And then there's so-called Kingdom Monera, which takes on everything else. As I like to say, that the five kingdom system, although it made a lot of sense and it had less of a bias than the previous systems that were employed, nevertheless, definitely had a bias towards big things versus small ones. Line length here basically is a representation of genetic distance. The longer the line, the more different two organisms are. And these are built based upon what's known as small subunit RNA, ribosomal RNA. The sequence. And this is an attempt to basically separate out the microorganisms from the non-microorganisms or the macroorganisms. These mostly are the animals, the fungi, and the plants. You also have the eukaryotic, large multicellular eukaryotic algae, which would be somewhere around here. And the slime molds are also included in this list because they're definitely not microorganisms in their mature state. They're without question visible to the naked eye. And we'll be talking about evolution of virulence in this course, and this is also something that I've had for about the past 2 decades. Actually, it's more like 18, 19 years. This I made the first semester or quarter that I was teaching ever. And at the time, I was very interested in the evolution of virulence of microorganisms. I still am to a degree. And so my representation here is just to give you a sense of how the virulence of organisms can differ and how that can affect the Darwinian fitness of an organism, kind of a transition to a more evolutionary thinking in the course. And virulence is basically the capacity for an organism to cause disease. And what we have here is 2 different types of pathogens. One of them makes me, Micro Dude, not very sick, but I'm still sick, I'm still coughing, versus me, Micro Dude, very sick. And what I'm doing here is I'm sufficiently not sick that I'm able to come to a class and I'm coughing all over everybody, and everybody else presumably will get sick. Now, there's a cost to not making me sick, and that is that the microorganism, the pathogen, may not be replicating as effectively or to as high levels. So it might not be able to transmit as effectively per opportunity to transmit, but there might be many more opportunities to transmit because I'm not sick enough to stay home from work. Whereas here I am sick enough to stay home from work. I'm out of it. I'm coughing and coughing and coughing, coughing my lungs out. But despite that, Despite probably having the potential to really make others sick if they should come in my contact, I'm not coming in contact with anybody because I'm at home in bed. So we'll talk about ideas like that quite a bit. An entire chapter devoted to virulence.